Hello, this is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And spring has sprung, more or less, here in High Wycombe. There's certainly hay fever about.
Yeah, it's too hot.
Too hot. Well, you just wait, mate. You just wait. You talk of too hot now. I have sad news, and I'm feeling sad despite the spring, that Alarms and Excursions, the venerable role-playing apazine, which I've written for the past, oh my God, fathers, how many years?
Longer than we've been doing this by a fair old margin.
By a fair old margin, is folding after after 50 years of publication. Lee Gold, who has edited it since Stardust, had health issues and feels she can no longer continue. Which is making me feel, as I say, sad. There may be, I sort of hope there will be, a continuation in PDF form, but it looks as though its print run has finally come to an end. So I shall go and mourn with a glass of the finest and hope that Lee recovers from her current emergencies.
Yeah, so. I haven't had as much to do with her as you, but we met a fair few times in the 90s, and yeah, Lee is a good thing.
Yes, good. All right, on to we still receive briefings on what's coming up, and free samples too, from the bundle of holding. And we mention it when we think we've got something of interest. And I think there's something of interest to both of us this week. This should still be active for about a week after this episode drops. It consists of, first of all, a history of Traveller, the role-playing game, the oldest, well, just about the oldest, certainly the oldest surviving science fiction role-playing game. And a history of it, of GDW, and all the things that went into creating something that's lasted a long time. I'm reading through the chapters about the creation of the idea of the Third Imperium at the moment. There's a lot of stuff in there which happened for the first time with Traveller, and for somebody who is enthusiastic and remembers those days, an enthusiastic amateur historian, it's definitely of interest. Over the next few days, they're going to be putting up repeats of their earlier Traveller bundles, and they're doing this for the most fannish of reasons, because May Day is coming up. And they decided that May Day, because of the cover of the first edition, is going to be Traveller Day.
Good yeah. Grief. So what this means in terms of our recording schedule is that the only offer we actually have details on is this specific one, which is Shannon Appleklein's book Free Trader Beowulf, which, as you say, is basically the history of the system. More offers are expected. I think the idea is that the rest of the offers will be revised, but we cannot be authoritative about that. This specific offer ends on the 7th of May.
Yeah.
I have skimmed the book. I would class it as more of an annotated list than of a discussion, though there is discursive stuff there. But yeah, you can't really have the informed discussion without the list first anyway, so fair enough.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that they originated was the idea of the licensed supplement.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know whether D&D had said you can publish stuff for D&D first, but certainly this was the first case of you can write a thing that is set in our universe.
Yeah. And it also gives the first evidence of that dread beast, the metaplot, when they decided that they were going to narrate in quotes real time the history or at least the current news of the Third Imperium as seen from the Traveller News Service on the Spinwood Marches. And I think that is looking back on it, I don't think we knew how brilliant that was
or how terrible
All right,
we talked about that in a previous episode, which I'll link in the show notes.
Okay. But we would encourage you, and we probably have all the stuff that they're going to be offering, but that doesn't mean it won't be worth getting if you don't. I am restarting one of the campaigns I've talked about before, which is a group of investigators in the world of Steve Jackson Games' Banestorm, going about the Imperium of Megalosh, just ahead of one of the magistrates that the Emperor has sent out to clear up the mess of some backlog of cases dating from when his father, who had been replaced by a demon, was on the throne. It's a complicated backstory. You don't have to worry about this. But we have a group...
The previous emperor's little health problem, yes.
Yes, yes. Being dead and replaced by a demon. It's not a common syndrome, even amongst emperors. So this is a group of bold investigators, spies, infiltrators and lawyers going ahead of the magistrate to investigate things that are going to be coming up into his in-tray any day soon now. And I had a successful first season. I'm returning to it. And I thought we might take this opportunity to talk about what happens when you're playing the authorities, when you are the cops. Now, there have been... I don't know... if there have been many actual campaigns set in police stations, set in investigative organisations, other than those that go out and investigate things like the Cthulhu mythos. But we have been able to draw upon, and I'm going to draw upon heavily, on Lisa J. Steele's two GURPS supplements, Cops and Mysteries.
Mysteries is one of my favourite GURPS supplements, as I often say. And Cops is, well, some two minor disadvantages. One, it's for third edition, and two, it's very American in setup. But if what you want to do is an American-style police force, it has very much got the organisation and procedures that you'll need.
One of the problems with that proposition is that, well, problems and advantages of that proposition is that each individual state and often each individual city has a substantial amount of unique law going around, and things, though they form into general patterns, aren't always exactly the same. So you can introduce difficulties and opportunities pretty much according to a certain level of whim when you're designing a fictional setting there. I think that falls under... the one time I did attempt to do a cop show, I set it in the same nameless city as was the setting for Hill Street Blues, which gave me a certain amount of flexibility and the advantage. But be this as it may.
So we should just mention that Lisa is, in real life, a criminal defence attorney, quite a well-respected one. She knows what she's talking about.
And she'll tell you a lot of what she knows in these two books.
Should say that, first of all, there is a, at least in my sense, it, for me, a cultural bias, because we get a lot of American cop shows.
And
this has been happening for some years.
I don't actually remember seeing Dragonet when it was on, if it ever was. But I do remember... I do remember Ironside, and I probably saw some Barry Mason as well.
And they have a concern which is also a concern for PCs. They want to show the cops as the good guys, and PCs want to be the good guys. And there is this assumption on all of them that the police are fundamentally the good guys. They may be a bit flawed, see The Wire, but they are basically trying to do the right thing, even if they're not always allowed to. And depending on where you live, this may be more or less true. I don't want to get into the political side of this. I think it's pretty obvious, really. But it's something the players want to be able to believe of their characters.
Yeah, and the difficulty is?
Well, the problem can be that something like CSI, which is the American cop show I've seen most of, tends to fall into this and say that there is this problem that I've seen in a lot of specialised jobs. I've certainly seen it in system administration that I've done a lot of,
yeah.
but it's very much a risk for police and military in particular, that the civilians, which is everybody who is not actually one of us, just including your own senior management, just do not understand.
No, yeah.
They don't understand what we're trying to do. They're putting these rules on us which stop us doing the job right. It's very much us and them. That's why I think Lisa was such a good person to write GURPS Cops, because as a criminal defence attorney, she is very specifically one of them as far as the police are concerned.
Yeah, I think there is... it's exaggerated in the case of police and military. But there is a tendency for everybody to assume that their job is difficult and important, and everybody else's job is easier and trivial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody views the world in that way, though actors do have some difficulty. But we can take ourselves seriously, even when we really shouldn't be.
Actors are usually not armed, though.
Yes, true. I will point to the Peelian principles of of the founding father of all the British constabularies, which says we can't afford to put enough armed soldiers onto the streets to control the population. We have no alternative but to ensure that the people regard the police as their allies and part of them. And the police regard the people as their allies and them as a part of the people. I would say it's broken down. I'm not sure it was ever that firmly entrenched in the United States. And it has broken down in the United Kingdom to a certain extent in recent years. But I think it's still there. There is a problem of finding somebody to police the police. That's always going to be a problem.
And one of the American cliches, which, as far as I know of my limited real-world experience of the police, tends to be true in the UK as well, is everybody hates internal affairs or equivalent. Because they are outsiders, as discussed. You know, they don't understand the pressures we're under, etc. Though they may well be perfectly competent police in their own right, who have done the same job as you until they're transferred to internal affairs.
Yeah. But there is a culture that says that they are the ones who sneak to teacher. I'm not sure. Maybe we should talk later about the difficulties of and opportunities of running a campaign where you can't trust your superiors, or you shouldn't trust your superiors, or there are some people in the force who you can't trust. I think that's something you want to float for a part of a campaign, but not a whole of a campaign. I don't think in this entertainment focused art form that we're in, I don't think you can stretch tension and distrust and there being nobody out there who you can trust to a whole campaign. But I think it would make
Or it becomes its own thing, possibly. Well, I mean, to some extent, you've run Knights Black Agents. That's more or less what that's trying to do, isn't it?
Not in
a police context, but, you know, everybody you'd relied on has abandoned you.
Yeah, you've been thrown outside the establishment that used to protect you, and now you discover that parts of the establishment are corrupted by the undead. And you're the ones who have to do something about it. Lucky you.
And the way I see it, the American cop show orthodoxy would be: you can have somebody who is a corrupt police, but it will be discovered and resolved within a single episode, and they are definitely shown as the exception.
I think
a role-playing game could stretch that a little bit and say, you know, here is dodgy Bob who's been on the force for years and he's a good cop, but he takes some shortcuts, and eventually that might come to a head and, no, we actually have to go up against him now because he is compromising the stuff we need to do. But as you say, I agree, it doesn't want to be the primary focus of the thing.
I will mention, just in passing about my own current campaign, that what we have here is a team of outsiders coming into local jurisdictions all over the place and upsetting people who have either corruptly or incompetently failed to investigate things and failed to discover what there is to discover. And this does not give them a whole lot of love. And this being the second season, I'm planning on having their reputation having gone ahead of them and people starting to take active countermeasures where they dare.
And presumably a certain amount of that reputation is they came to place and the local, whatever form it takes, law enforcement chief, depending on which version of the story they've heard, was either promoted or is now awaiting trial.
In one case, they go to a place and it turns out that the Duke's advisor was a vampire. Can you imagine?
This is a consideration that is very nationally based, because what we're both used to is the British model, which these days England has 39 territorial forces, to use the technical term, i.e. they have responsibility for a particular area.
Yeah.
Some of them are huge, one or two of them are really tiny.
And I think it's three national forces, which the Ministry of Defence, the Transport Police, and the Civil Nuclear Constabulary, who are escorts for bits of glowing metal.
Yeah, I mean, the ModPlod and the CNC are basically, we want to have armed security who are not technically military, so that we can put them on convoys, on vehicles, whatever, and say this is a civilian vehicle. It just happens to have armed security. British Transport Police, it's basically because, a train can go a long way in a short time.
Yeah.
And so they have responsibility for the stuff that happens there. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of local cooperation.
I think the
other one that one might consider, though it's not a distinct force, is the National Crime Agency, which is basically, it's obviously modelled slightly after the FBI, though we don't have quite the same problems with it, with having a national police force in the first place. Don't have the same need for it, because the forces already cooperate all the time anyway. There are fewer of them and they're larger. But this is basically for organised crime and things of that sort, that it may not have a geographical basis.
I get the impression they're primarily information gatherers. Do they actually have an active detective branch that goes out and does things?
Not entirely clear, but I don't think so. I mean, basically, they will liaise with a local force, and the local force will be supplying most of the manpower.
However, back in the 1930s, there was a milder version of the problem that local forces in the United States have with the FBI, when Scotland Yard had the largest detective force and was frequently loaning people out to county forces which didn't have the numbers. And it was resented.
Quite possibly didn't have the specialised knowledge. This is frankly the early days of forensic science, but this is one of the clichés of the 1920s, 1930s murder mystery, that the local police are basically clodhoppers and the man from Scotland Yard comes down to deal with the country house murder.
And then he asks Sherlock Holmes or Peter Wimsey in to do the actual work.
Yeah, but the cliche is definitely, the guy from the top is going to come in, we're going to do all the work, he's going to get all the glory. Though obviously in a game you can ring changes on that, especially if you are the guys from the top.
We should probably mention that, all right, I'll take the opportunity to mention at this point in time that CSI don't do that things like that, and they don't do them
absolutely
that quick neither.
This is, to me, the biggest obstacle in a police campaign that's trying to be vaguely modern world realistic, which is a combination of party size and niche protection. If you are, let us say, a police detective, even a moderately cinematic one, the person you go out and do things with is your partner, who is also a police detective who has had basically the same training as you, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. They are not six of you. And they are not, you know, two detectives and a forensic scientist and a beat cop all going out to do something together. These things just don't happen. You can twiddle it a bit, but if you're trying to be realistic about it, you know, six of you turn up to interview the little old lady who saw something weird.
Yeah.
You're not all going to fit in her living room. She probably doesn't have enough teacups.
All right. This is the thing that's at the top of my notes.
Yeah.
This is the problem is that none of the very few of the standard tropes of detective stories actually fit with a group of five or six people gathered around a table chatting at each other. They don't actually fit the adventuring party motif, which we're still using because legacy stuff. So you mentioned when I proposed this the session of one-on-one gumshoe that we ran some time back. We found that very good because it is the natural thing, especially when you're playing some sort of maverick, some sort of lone wolf who's out there fighting unnameable things because nobody else is daft enough to do it. That worked very well. It's a very intense role-playing experience. I think that one referee and two players would be actually a natural fit.
Agreed.
For most investigations. You have the senior detective, you have the junior detective who can perhaps get away with things, or if you're using the amateur detective consultant, can go places that the person with the authority can't go, and that might be, I've never tried it, but that might be a perfect fit for the classic detective mystery. But much bigger than that, and you're forced into one of two things. Either my approach of the task force that's been sent in to do a specific number of things in a specific area, something like, what's it called, the criminal minds, the FBI profiling section, can believably be sent into areas which are having an outburst of serial killing. They're not as often as it happens in the show. To aid the local police and just try to aggressively throw everything they've got at the problem and see if anything falls out. But other than that, the only solution I can see to doing a cop show is to do a precinct-based cop show in which you're breaking the people up, you're deliberately splitting them up into teams and individuals and sending them off to do things.
Yeah.
And that changes from week to week because there may be a crime of the week. There is if it's a precinct based place stuck in one place, then it's going to be strong on soap opera because you can do that sort of thing if the characters stay in one place and have relationships with each other and outside the force. But I think those are the two options that you're left with.
Yeah, as I see it, again, looking at something like CSI and quite a lot of other shows, you have quite a lot of regulars. Obviously, they are ranked between the least and the most important, but you know, you might have five or six people who are the regular lab staff. Who are in the opening credits, but most scenes are going to have two of them talking to each other, maybe three. And in a role-playing game context, that means you have some players sitting around, or possibly you have some players playing multiple characters, or you have players playing NPCs.
I had thought that there might be an opportunity to use the troop play idea from Ars Magica. And it also occurred to me that it might be a good use for the model from Primetime Adventures, which is designed to give the focus for one session to a particular character, and move the others to the background. And as long as everybody gets a share of the glory, then that isn't too bad from the point of view of keeping players happy.
Hmm.
But, you might well. I honestly don't think you want to have the wonder workers, whether they're magicians or they're technicians. I don't know that you want them in the foreground. And I think what your primary job would be in that sort of, as the GM in that sort of situation, is to control the flow of the information they've sent for, so it arrives at dramatically appropriate moments.
Mm.
A story convenient moment.
I think there are some distinctive things that make a cop story a cop story.
Go on.
It's not a spy show. It's not a caper show like Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
Even though those guys are theoretically working for the good guys. It's
basically
reactive.
Yeah.
That this crime has happened. This crime is happening. Go and do something about it. Yes, in the real world there is crime prevention, but that is generally not the job of the police. Though you might, for comic relief, send one or two of them on a school visit to educate the kids about something. But it is comic relief. That's the first way it comes to my mind.
Yeah.
It is basically about working within the law, with quite tight constraints on what you can get away with, at least in other jurisdictions may work differently, but that's certainly the way it is in my head. And police are an organisation. The cliche of you may be able to get away from that one cop who's shooting at you, but you can't outrun Motorola. You know, they will get the roadblock in place before you can get there.
Yeah.
They can call for backup. Maybe that's more of the same. Maybe that's something different. Like, if they need somebody with specialised skills, there is probably somebody whose job it is to produce those specialised skills. And they are working within a society.
Yes.
There have certainly been fantasy games in particular. We've talked about the connection with the Old West pulp approach there, where you've got the roving good guy, but he is the roving good guy. He is coming in because there isn't a working society, and he is solving the problem of the week, and he's going away again. That is not a police story, even though he is doing things possibly quite similar to what the police would be doing, because he doesn't have the backup. It's just him. And all right, technically, in the real world, you have had something like the early Texas Rangers.
Yeah.
Where, yes, you are technically a police force in any formal sense, but you are not working within the working society. Your job is to go and be the local police until the local crime calms down for a bit, and then go on and do it somewhere else, because they don't have the resources to have a police force everywhere.
Yeah, there's an interesting example of the visiting police force in Dogs in the Vineyard, which failed for other reasons, but in my opinion. But it was an interesting setup. You are the roving judges of not the Mormons, really, and you're going out and seeking out the devil and heresy and what have you, and deciding whether there is heresy or the devil in a particular location.
Strangely enough, when you look for heresy, you very often find it.
It's true. And the devil pops up when you mention him. Ah, never mind.
I think that there are a couple of scales one could consider here, which is, if we define a police campaign to some extent as being the authorities, then how much power do you have and how much responsibility do you have? In one corner of this, you get James Bond.
Yeah.
Who is described in the film of Dr. No as a stupid policeman, and he describes himself in the books occasionally as a sort of policeman. He's definitely working for the authorities, but nobody's going to send him the bill for the car chase.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he can't arrest people. He can't. Yeah, he can't wave a card at the local police and get instant cooperation. So that's one corner of it. He doesn't even tell the local police he's going to be working there.
On the other hand, if he shoots somebody dead, nobody's going to hold a court of inquiry that anybody will ever hear about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the central threads of the contract of the GM player's contract in this, that legal enforcement powers is what Gertz calls it, and it comes in several levels. The policeman on the beat, even the detective inspector called in from the nearest town, have limited reach up the hierarchy to be able to get things done. But they do have reach. They have, in effect, patrons or contacts who will back them up to a degree, but will fail. It's probably better that's limited by how frequently they've asked recently and how high they're asking the favour to be, rather than a simple dice roll. But
And you, the cop on the beat, cannot call in the specialised, extremely weird stuff in investigation team, but you can talk to your superior, who can talk to his superior, and if you have enough evidence to convince them, then they can make some calls and make it happen. I should say, one of my, I guess I could use the term campaign attractor, as in a thing that a lot of my campaigns tend to centre on, is what you might call special police. In other words, you are police or something similar, but you are specialised in a particular sort of problem, which might be, for example, supernatural monsters.
Yeah, always a temptation.
Yeah. So I would tend to say for that, yeah, you don't have to worry about the occasional speeding ticket as you're on your way to a crime scene, but you're definitely working within the rules, and you're still going to have administration and paperwork to deal with and justification of stuff. Quite possibly the normal police aren't fully briefed on what's going on, but at the very least they know that if one of these particular weird things happen, they should make a phone call rather than try to deal with it themselves.
A constant problem in that sort of campaign is people find out that the weird stuff is going on, and what do you do about them?
Yeah, and the film's Men in Black have the easy way out of this, which is the instant amnesia device. But at the very least, I think you would want a set of standard excuses. This is why I used the Civil Nuclear Constabulary for my BCU Black campaign, because they have the built-in excuse of somebody released some nuclear material, you can't come into this area.
Yeah, no, and almost nobody's ever heard of them, so nobody can notice how different your nuclear cops are from the average nuclear cop.
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, in reality, they are basically an armed security force. And they do not have detectives. So, yeah. I should mention a couple of fictional examples. Ben Aronovich's Rivers of London series, which I gather now has its own RPG as well, is an obvious model for this. They are the specialised magic cops, and it's a bit hazy just how much the rest of the world knows, but at the very least, somebody moderately senior can say, yeah, this is weird calling those guys.
Yeah.
There's also Paul Cornell's Shadow Police series, which starts off similarly, but it very rapidly goes off into we are chasing our own hares and we are just technically police as well. So, less good as an example for this particular thing.
Yeah. Can I mention something to do with magic? I'm running my current campaign under GURPS, and there is such a thing, a spell as Truthsayer and Compel Truth. And I find that's something I have to manage. I think I'm mostly managing it by resource allocation. They don't have somebody on the team who can do that sort of spell. I did offer, but he decided it wasn't interesting. And what I'm basically doing is saying, well, you're going to have to get somebody from outside the team to come in and do the job, and that will require forms, and they'll be here the day after tomorrow. And between now and the day after tomorrow, I can throw a lot of stuff at them and keep it from being the way to solve the problem. But I don't think you should be so stingy as to deny it to them entirely. It only works when they've got the right person in custody or somebody in custody who doesn't want to talk and can give them the information with a little bit of well-role-played magical oogly-boogly.
Well, one example that's possibly worth stealing from H.B. and Piper's Fuzzy series.
Go on.
That setting in general, but it's the Fuzzy books where he particularly looks into this. There is the neural veridicator. Hmm. Which is effectively a lie detector that actually works, unlike the ones in the real world.
See Star Trek also.
It specifically detects the intention to make a false statement or construct a false statement in your mind.
Yeah.
And the great big blue globe behind you flashes up red when this happens. Now, this is used at trial, not during interrogation, for a start. But also, they still have lawyers. So, example one. You make a plea of not guilty. You know you did it. But that's fine. You are making a plea of not guilty. You are not saying you didn't do it. Those are two different things. The competent criminal is able to realise and remember that those are two different things.
Yeah.
There is still protection from self-incrimination. So
one wonders why and how it managed to survive.
I think, well, no, this is the same series in which the hundreds of years in the future, humans from Earth still have cocktail hour. So, you know, basically there is still room for, I'm not going to accept that question. I'm not saying it has all the answers, but it's a good example of, here is this thing which you would think would short circuit, would make courts irrelevant, and he's going to some effort to show how it doesn't.
Yeah, I think I find it a little unbelievable that that they wouldn't use it in interrogation, because interrogation is the point at which it's needed. And yes, you can say, I decline to answer that question, or I will not answer. Sometimes you can make a story out of the fact that they've got a good reason not to, but the cops may have decided they're guilty and may ball through, but more subtle questioning might bring out the actual truth of the matter. As I say, I think it's something you want to save for a climactic moment. And,
at the very least, you need to think through, I think, how this particular place, this jurisdiction, has come to terms with the existence of this thing.
Yeah.
It's not obvious, but it may make things have quite a different shape from what we subconsciously expect.
I have had problems with the lawyer in my group who tends to think that English law applies universally. And it don't. Multiversely. No. It's a terrible neologism, Michael. Bad, Michael.
I would like to hark back to the Pelian principle slightly, because this whole thing about police are people within a working society. An example of a police force that isn't, but hasn't realised it yet, is Mad Max, the first film.
Yeah. You know, I haven't seen the first film.
The world is going to hell. But they are still cops. They are still going out and going on patrol and arresting people, and those people are getting lawyers and trials and things. Hmm. The society has shifted enough that this isn't really working anymore. But they have to gradually come to realise it, rather than just immediately putting on the leather and chrome and going out and killing people. One particular example that is generally completely ignored, and I think it's quite important, is the end of Dirty Harry, the first film of that series.
When he throws his gun and his badge away?
Yeah. He for the whole film he's been on the edges of what's allowable. Fair enough. He has finally gone outside that, and he knows he's gone outside it to get the bad guy. And as I see it, he is aware that he is not fit to be a police anymore. You can argue whether that's because they won't let him, or whether because he just knows he's not suited for it. because, you know, obviously he's going to have the temptation to do it again the next time there's a problem. I actually favour the latter interpretation. It's possibly a bit subtle for the film, but obviously when the film was a success, they completely ignored that and just sent him straight back in. But that is an important thing. There are a lot of campaign exits here for characters who, for whatever reason, maybe the player is leaving the group or whatever, but if you want to retire a character, there are lots of ways out other than just getting injured or killed. There is, you know, I just cannot make these decisions anymore, particularly if you've got an armed force. I've been good enough that I'm getting promoted to those shiny cops who come in and spoil our fun. There are lots of possibilities, and I think that's worth considering.
I have one character in my current campaign who is the archetypical honest cop who has been transferred to this unit because of his tendency to report on his superiors. and I suspect I'm going to twist things a bit. The setting is a recovering evil empire, and there are still plenty of bits that are evil. There are probably going to be a touch of heresy trial in the future, and I'm not sure if somebody who has faith in the law as such, rather than justice in the law, is going to be unchanged by the events I plan on throwing at them.
But that's very much the sort of thing that I think a cop campaign should deal with.
Yeah.
You may well come in naively thinking that those are basically going to be the same thing, and then, no, they clearly aren't.
Yeah. I don't know if they teach that at the academy. Speaking of which, I haven't been watching, but I've been seeing a lot of clips on YouTube for an American series called The Rookie, which starts out as being about a man who has a middle-aged crisis and decides to become... to allow himself to be recruited into the cops, and of course he's terribly good at it. One of the things that this allows is the fact that all the rookies, not just him, but all the rookies are in their first years under the guidance of a training officer, mm-hmm. and that solves the problem of people going out on their own. Patrol officers normally go out on their own. So you've got people...
I think in American police, at least, they usually go in pairs.
Yeah. Well, they seem to on in the movies anyway. Lisa says otherwise in Girls Cops.
But I'm not going to say she's wrong. She knows way more about it than I do.
Yeah. But that solves one problem. And another thing that it allows to bring in is the incompetent opposition, because he wants comedy moments, as Lisa says, as everybody says, most criminals aren't terribly bright,
mm-hmm.
and they get themselves into desperately bad situations entirely of their own making.
And this was the fundamental premise of my Weird Florida campaign.
Florida Man, the enemy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was my scenario generator. Florida Man headlines.
I'm going to put two possibilities we've already talked about to the front for complications. Superiors, trustworthy, untrustworthy, or mixed. And the cause you're fighting for, just or unjust, or ambiguous. And I'm going to suggest that ambiguous and mixed are the best settings for these as possibilities. Because... yes, you do some things that and go out, but for the second or third season, I think you want to introduce the idea that somewhere up the chain you're serving people who you would not wish to serve, and somewhere you come to the limits of what you find you can approve of in the law.
In a Marxist analysis, the purpose of the police is to protect capital. And that's perhaps simplistic, but there's certainly a lot of that about. And somebody who's signed up to help people is going to run up against that eventually.
I was really annoyed with the Blair government when they took away the part of the police oath which said with fear and favour towards none, because they thought it would be too complicated for new recruits to understand. And rather, that's at the core of being a policeman. You do not favour sides. You go where the law says, and you do not respect persons to favour them or fear them. And if that goes, then I'm having these young people today, even if they are retired prime ministers,
That is a consideration, of course. Looking at the rookie as well, most police recruits are picked quite young, because apart from anything else, they want young and fit people on the beat. Even by the time somebody is a detective, they have probably spent most of their adult life in police-related activities, and that is one of the reasons why you don't get to go much outside the skills template. Hmm. And the advantage of a situation like the rookie, the big name actor who's doing this midlife crisis thing is only one of the three recruits we're broadly following, and he's the only one who is older, but at least one of the characters has a set of skills that he's acquired outside the police. Mm. And from a gaming point of view, that's obviously a great thing to add in.
Another depressing reason for getting them young is that you can use them as undercovers while they're still naive and unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And that depresses me slightly.
Especially with the recent change to the law in the UK that says basically they can't be prosecuted for anything illegal they do while undercover. Such as, for example, rape, which there's quite a lot of, it seems. I would like to mention David Simon's book, Homicide: A Year on the Killing Streets.
That was the basis of Homicide: Life on the Streets?
Yeah. Basically, he spent a year hanging around the Baltimore Police's homicide squad, or one of those squads. Where it falls, I think it is the problem we talked about already, that basically the people he was hanging around were the cops, and he has absorbed the attitudes of the cops, which is realistic if you're going to write about them, but it doesn't make for a balanced approach to... As far as they're concerned, they send a case to court, that guy is guilty, and the court should be a mere formality, and if they're acquitted, then that must be some smart lawyer playing paperwork games, as opposed to you just banged that guy up because he was convenient, which is clearly sometimes the case. So
But
in spite of this, yeah. it is a very good book in terms of just the police life of its period. Obviously, I don't know how much it may have changed since, but it's well worth at least bringing into your influences.
I worked for the DWP fraud section, and I was a very lowly functionary. But there was a case where I thought we had him banged to rights, and it went up to trial, and he got off. I wasn't there. I was no longer employed by them, but I heard he got off afterwards. And I felt that cunning lawyers...
Which is obviously a real thing as well.
Spinning a tail. Mind you, I think the attitude there was slightly different, because basically they had to produce a certain number of cases which were taken to trial on a quota basis, and they tried to put the best ones forward and give the rest of them the chance to say, "Where you're going to pay a 30% surcharge and be cautioned, and that'll be it." And most people were sensible enough to go for, I'll take the caution and the surcharge, please.
Mm. Which you can't really do when it's murder.
It's true. What's it called? Wergild is no longer a part of British jurisprudence. Fortunately, probably. All right, I think we have given a good roam over this, with hints and planning of things we're going to do in the future. Have done in the past. So I think we will say to our faithful listeners, be careful out there.
Mind how you go.
If you have tales of crimes and misdemeanors, of strange happenings up in the woods, and how you believe the Chief Constable is responsible, then you can send them to us via...
Leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.li.
I will see you again in a month.